News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. James Tulsky about palliative care. But first, Adam, we are going to transition into research that matters.
Yeah, you know, Christy, we actually have some really interesting research that looks at some really exciting possibilities for, in the very first case, what maybe we can cure really overweight, obese adolescents. And we've talked about this a little bit in our show, but this is actually something we might be surprised from our listeners. We're talking about surgery.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre that this sounds so positive, but we're talking about the real epidemic of obesity in our country, and particularly about teenagers with obesity. So we're talking about more than 5 million young people in the United States alone that are in the category of obese.
Yeah, and this was actually to look at what is a common surgical approach in adults, which is laparoscopic gastric banding or kind of stapling of the stomach in severely obese adolescents in a randomized trial taking 15 really obese adolescents. Actually, it was in Australia, and they either went in a supervised lifestyle intervention or they underwent this gastric banding procedure and followed them for 2 years.
Yeah, so they took 50 teenagers between 14 and 18 years who had what we call a body mass index or BMI greater than 35 and followed them over 2 years. And they were looking to see how much weight did they lose and was there any change in some other things like metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, and any adverse outcomes or bad things that could have happened from the surgery.
Right. And while, you know, this isn't a large number, and so you, if you were expecting that you might have some significant bad outcomes, you might want a lot more patients to be able to see. The positive side of this was really pretty amazing, Christy, that 24 out of the 25 patients in the gastric banding group actually completed the study compared to only 18 of 25 in the lifestyle group. And more importantly, 84% of those in the gastric banding compared to only 12% in the lifestyle group lost more than 50% of their excess weight. That's pretty impressive.
And the mean changes in the gastric banding group were a weight loss of 34.6 kilograms. So multiply that by 2.2, talking about a lot of pounds.
Almost 80 pounds. So these were really overweight adolescents.
And they lost, I mean, that's almost 80 pounds compared with in the lifestyle group, they only lost maybe 8.
Yeah, and we know that people in these sorts of studies in the lifestyle groups are getting the best care followed closely. So that's kind of the best outcomes. Real-world outcomes frequently in lifestyle interventions are actually less than that.
Mm-hmm. And although the numbers were small and they followed it out, none of the participants in the gastric banding group had metabolic syndrome at the end. So they 9 started out with it, and then none of them had it by the end of 2 years.
Yeah, and to be fair, the gastric banding did require some additional procedures in order to fix some of the complications, but these weren't serious. And I think this, again, is another option potentially to consider, and we will be talking more about it because the outcomes for these incredibly overweight adolescents are really, really bad if we don't reverse it.
Yeah, I mean, I really think our efforts need to go into primary prevention of trying to prevent all of our children from getting that obese. But certainly once you've gotten to that point, this is a real option and shown to be effective. So let's do our next one.
Yeah, our next one is really interesting, which really takes, you know, really kind of looks at this opposite impact, which we were looking at, you know, really overweight adolescents, Christy, and, you know, what can we do to prevent really bad outcomes? And this is now looking at the community. But not of overweight, but in this particular case, noise and, you know, is being exposed to loud noises on a community scale, for instance, living right next to a highway or living right along railroad tracks, is your risk of heart disease actually greater from that kind of stress?
Yeah. So they looked at 659 people and broke them up into, it was a group of people who were exposed to road traffic noise, and then a control group of people in the community who were not exposed to that sort of noise. And then they tried to calculate a 10-year risk of developing heart disease over time using some very standardized scores of the Framingham risk studies that are pretty standard in the medical community.
Yeah, and they found that there was a much higher risk in those who were exposed to this community noise. And than those who were not. You know, it's really interesting because, you know, there are lots of neighborhoods in our region in which people live right next to highways, and they hear this constant drone of the highway there. And you sometimes think, God, what's it like to live there? And, well, you know, what can we do about this? And this, I think, is some weight to say that, you know, environmental noise is a health risk that, in the absence of better data, Christy, maybe we should do something about by erecting some barriers.
Sure. Well, it's hard to know, is the noise causing that, or is it something about the people in the community that end up living beside loud noise that makes them at higher risk for heart disease? So, I don't think you can draw a causal effect here, but certainly something we need to investigate further. And it does make sense that hearing really loud things might just drive up your blood pressure a little bit, but it's hard to know.
Yeah, it's certainly a little bothersome, and it makes me a little more aware potentially of the impact of those things than perhaps I would be otherwise. What's our very next research that matters?
Okay, this is about online. So we've talked about using telemedicine and using different ways of taking care of people, and this is another one about online therapy for depression. So they looked at two different ways of providing therapy for people who have depression, this thing called cognitive behavioral therapy and problem-solving therapy.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that is interesting is there certain forms of therapy better? So, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy really focuses on your thoughts and ways to modify the thoughts. If you're having negative thoughts all the time, how to have less negative, more positive thoughts versus the problem-solving therapy, which is more of a modality maybe that many family docs, I know Christy and I were trained in, which is to say, let's focus on what your current problems are and how to make them better and see which of those two actually may be better.
And what they found were that both treatments were more effective than a control group in reducing certain symptoms like dysfunctional attitudes, worry, negative problem orientation, and enhancing feelings of control.
Yeah, and so this would suggest really that if you're, as with many people, if you're depressed and are having some significant impacts on your life, that really talking with your family doctor, your primary care provider, your therapist about the kinds of things that you're experiencing will probably actually be beneficial for you, even in the absence of medication, because you're going to impact on some of these thoughts, some of these problems, the things that are all contributing here. And even if you do it as an online like they did here, it'll have some benefit for you.
Yeah. So our next study is another one on healthcare reform, or really what would happen if we do nothing to change our healthcare system.
You know, we've talked in the past about Christy and I's frustration with some of the changes happening or the lack of changes in healthcare reform. And this in the New York Times was a very interesting analysis that showed, you know, what would have happened if we had instituted the types of healthcare reforms that actually were proposed under three different presidents over the last three decades by President Nixon, President Carter, and President Clinton, each of which would have showed how much of our gross domestic product was spent on healthcare, which is now close to almost 18%. Unbelievable. But if we had instituted those reforms under President Nixon, we would only be spending 10.7%. And even under Clinton's reforms that were done much later, it would have been only 14%.
Yeah, and it's really remarkable the slope of the curve at how quickly we're growing in cost. And the most striking difference here is the comparison between our median national healthcare expenses as a percentage of GDP compared with what it is in 30 different industrialized countries, and just the difference in how much more we spend compared with the rest of the developed
world.
Almost
twice as much.
Almost twice as much, and yet our health outcomes aren't any better.
And if we don't do anything, the Commonwealth Fund estimates that by 2020, 24% of our gross domestic product will be spent on healthcare. And I thought when we were at 14%, it couldn't get much worse, yet it apparently is. And so this is the imperative as listeners out there, and for all of us to recognize that doing nothing is not an option. It will get much worse. And the discussion we'll be having in 5 and 10 years from now is, well, what would have happened and how could we have reduced it if we'd intervened earlier, like we could have done under President Nixon, President Carter, President Clinton's healthcare reform proposals?
Yep. Tell us how it is, Adam.
That's the way it is, and we can tell how we feel.
All right.
That's going to probably conclude our research that matters. We've had a chance to talk a little bit today about environmental noise and heart risk.
A little bit about laparoscopic banding for teenagers with severe obesity.
What you can do either with cognitive behavioral therapy or even problem-solving therapy will get you hopefully to a good place with depressive symptoms.
And a little bit about our thoughts on healthcare reform and the fact that we need to have it.
Well, we're going to take a short break. break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. James Tolsky, our second in our series on medicine and ethics about palliative care. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about palliative care, and this is the second topic on our series of topics on medical ethics. Palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problem associated with life-threatening illnesses through prevention or relief of suffering. And this is something that Adam and I are involved in very intimately with our patients and their families, making decisions about end-of-life care, trying to relieve pain and suffering, and thinking about quality of life. And we're also involved in teaching residents and young doctors on how to do this well. So we are so happy to have a conversation with a specialist in the field.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome Dr. James Tolsky to Here's to Your Health. And Dr. Tolsky is the director of the Center for Palliative Care and professor of medicine and nursing at Duke University and the Durham VA Medical Center. Dr. Tolsky really has traveled in his training, starting at Cornell for undergraduate training and Illinois for medical school, and then moving out to the West to University of San Francisco. For his training in internal medicine and subsequently Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program before ultimately coming to Duke University down here in the Southeast. And Dr. Tolsky is really nationally and internationally known for his work and publication in doctor-patient communication and quality of care and life at the end of life. And it's really a pleasure to have you here with us, Dr. Tolsky, today to talk about some of the ethical issues really involved in end-of-life discussions.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the things Adam and I love to hear from our guests is a bit about your journey, about how you became passionate about palliative care in such an important field.
And also, help us define a little bit better is, you know, palliative care seems like that's a new term.
Palliative care is a new term, and it's one I think a lot of us are still struggling with and patients struggle with and doctors struggle with. But I've come to this really, I've been moving toward this my whole life. And the truth is, if you scratch most palliative care doctors a little bit, you'll find that they all have a story. Many of them had a relative who was perhaps very sick. Maybe they had a grandparent or a parent who was sick. I can't say that that's the case for me, but it did happen in the course of my training that I found that the patients I was most attracted to taking care of and the ones where I felt I added the most value were actually those who were suffering in this way. And I can remember as a third-year medical student telling a young Marine that he has stage 4 Hodgkin's disease and doing that rather than the resident because I felt that I wanted to protect that patient from the resident in that case who I was afraid wasn't going to do a good job. So that's been something I've been thinking about for a very long time.
Well, you know, giving the diagnosis, you mentioned that just kind of right up front in the story. And I wonder if, you know, I remember literature that suggests that there are right ways and wrong ways actually to get patients' diagnosis. And I remember so many times people leaving, being told stories about people leaving messages on the answering machine about
like,
cancer
oh,
diagnosis.
By the way.
Giving it on the telephone.
Oh.
Is that ethical in today's what we understand and know about today and the meaning of cancer for a patient and their family?
I think that giving bad news or even serious news over the telephone and certainly by a message machine is a huge problem and one that we should avoid at all costs. I recognize that there are times that doctors sometimes have to do this over the telephone when a patient's perhaps at a long distance. But whenever possible, it's so important to do this in person because the most important thing about giving bad news is recognizing the emotional impact of that news. And it's very hard to do that if you're not looking the person in the eye. And if you're not able to read how they're responding to the news, and then you can give the appropriate response back.
You're thinking about delivering bad news while we're on that topic, and you're telling the story of the resident where you didn't want that resident to give that information. You know, as we're in these training facilities and trying to teach people to do it well, You know, speak about the ethics of that, of allowing someone with less experience to have that conversation and how to mentor them through that. And perhaps they don't do it as well as you could, but yet how else do we teach people to do it?
You're absolutely right. And all of what we do in healthcare training is, you know, see one, do one, teach one, hopefully it's more than that, but there's this point at which we are exposing people, patients, to trainees who have somewhat limited skill. And this is the same thing with communication. We think a lot about this in terms of training people to do surgery or training people to do procedures, but we have to think about this with communication. What we do and what we recommend doing is, first of all, the residents, students, whoever, need to be trained. They need to understand that there's actually a cognitive framework for giving bad news. There are specific communication skills they can use that will help. So they need to know that first. Then I think they need to have observed someone doing a good job of it.
Yes.
So that's important. Then at the point at which they're ready to actually try it themselves, I don't think we should just be sending them in the room with a very sick patient and giving them the news. Instead, I think that the supervising physician, we call that the attending, should sit down with that resident, let's say, or student, and talk to them about what they're going to do and what are their goals, and then walk in with them together. And say to that person, it might come to a point where I'm actually going to take over the conversation. I just want to let you know that ahead of time. So that you prepare the learner to know that you may take control if you have to do that.
Sure. Wow. And then the follow-up feedback afterwards on what you could have done better.
Exactly.
And yes, absolutely. We're on the same page.
James Tulsky about palliative care. And, you know, Dr. Tulsky, one of the things that I sometimes struggle with, and maybe lots of doctors struggle with, is, you know, palliative care is about kind of end-of-life sorts of discussions. But what do we know really about end-of-life? How good are we at predicting what end-of-life means? And how do you think and describe that kind of conversation with patients?
What I usually want to do is find out what the patient's concerns are. And so the place I start is often with a question that says, when you think about the future, what do you think about? What are you most concerned about? Is there anything you're afraid of? Because the actual quality of that experience is going to be very different for different people, depending on the disease, depending on who they are and how they live their life. And so I need to find out what are the most important goals that they have, and then we can try to match the care that we give with those goals. And that's really what palliative care is all about.
You mean if someone may not be thinking, oh, I have 6 months to live, but, you know, in 2 months from now, I've got a grandchild getting born, and I really, that's important to me.
Exactly. And obviously a piece of this is letting them know that they have a limited time to live. If somebody has no idea about that, then they may not know that a particular goal is unreachable or that one is reachable.
I want to talk, speaking of predicting how long if someone's going to live, it's my understanding that doctors and patients refer to hospice far less than we should. So, I mean, this is an area that you're involved in. And part of that may be because doctors aren't very good at judging this whole 6 months to live thing, or maybe because they don't want to bring up to a family, or we don't want to face the fact that there is a limited amount of time to live, and maybe we don't have the answers. But I wonder if you could speak to that I think it's in some ways unethical for doctors not to be having these conversations and to bring in hospice or offering it soon enough.
Christy, I think you're right. I think it does border on the unethical if we don't give people an opportunity to reach their life completion in the way that they want to by knowing what's coming. I think that the reason you're right about both of your points. I think that doctors don't bring it up because we prognosticate very poorly. It's very hard for us to know really how long someone has to live. And I think many physicians are very uncomfortable talking about this. And even if they might be comfortable, they don't have the tools to do so. They don't actually know what language. So one of our jobs as educators in this field is to teach people those tools so they can walk into the conversation and talk about these things.
Yeah, I love the way you describe, Dr. Tulsky, people being able to achieve goals that they want to achieve. What a nice way of framing a conversation that in a positive way to be able to really accomplish something, whether you have a week or a month or 6 months or 20 years. And I don't think we as providers think about having that type of conversation. And I bet it's, what's it feel like when you frame it that way and a patient perhaps isn't expecting that? How does that feel when you frame it that way?
It can actually feel really wonderful, and it can be a way of developing a deep connection with a patient. So often these conversations are framed about what we're not going to do. We're no longer going to do chemotherapy. We're no longer going to have you on the ventilator. We're no longer going to do this or that. It's important to talk about what we are going to do, what goals we're going to achieve, and how can we can make the most out of the time that's left.
Beautifully stated.
You know, speaking of time that's left, Kristen.
I know. We do need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. James Tulsky, about palliative care. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You've been listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. James Tulsky from Duke University about palliative care and conversations and supportive conversations with patients and helping them achieve their goals. And I guess, Dr. Tulsky, one thing that I hear sometimes as a family practitioner, I know Christy does as well, is when a patient maybe no longer is a candidate for ongoing curative treatment, then they sometimes, their provider, they sometimes say, pulls back away from them, and they feel sometimes even alone and isolated. And what are the whole range of things that you as a palliative care provider and other primary care providers really need to be doing and thinking to really support the patient in all of these decisions?
Unfortunately, I've heard the same story. And I should mention that I work with a lot of oncologists and think they're committed, incredible doctors for the most part. I also know that it's hard, and that sometimes I think they get frustrated or they're at a loss for what to do in those times. And I can think of a number of patients. Specifically, I'm thinking of one young man with melanoma who was nearing the end of his life. There really were no more treatments that were going to reverse this disease. And the oncologist, although remaining involved, was really at a loss for how to handle the many kinds of issues that were coming up for his family at the very end. His pain, his inability to mobilize, dealing with his kids. There were just so many issues, other kinds of symptoms that were coming up. And this was all happening at home, and it was only actually at the very last minute in the last couple of days that he was finally referred to hospice, and a lot of these things were helped, but it was literally with just days to go. And so I think that palliative care can get involved with patients like this much earlier. There's no reason why a palliative care provider can't be involved concurrently with an oncologist or a heart failure specialist much earlier in the care. And then you can anticipate these sorts of problems before they come up and address them.
Well, and it also speaks to the value of a relationship with a primary doctor. I mean, if this patient you speak of had a primary doctor that they had a relationship with that they could be talking with, you would hope that that primary doctor could help navigate a lot of those family dynamics and also get a palliative care person in if needed, or maybe make that referral to hospice a little sooner.
I agree with you. And the problem is that right now, frequently, particularly when people get very specialized care like cancer care, the primary provider won't see the patient very much. You know, the primary care doctor will see the patient maybe periodically, but it's really the oncologist who's seeing the patient.
Right.
And I think we can do a much better job of coordinating that. I know that I do some primary care, and I try to stay on top of my patients even when they're undergoing these sorts of treatments.
Right. It also speaks to a value of communication between an oncologist and a primary care doctor to help keep that contact and keep that relationship nurtured so that a primary care doctor can be involved in helping make those transitions to palliative care when or if that's appropriate.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
You know, I know we're going to talk about communication, and you've written a book, and we want to talk about this in a second. But I want to just ask one question, Dr. Tulsky, that deals with maybe palliative care for patients that don't necessarily have cancer. For the patients that have had strokes, that have had pneumonia or dementia in particular, And so often when I'm rounding with our residents in the hospital, they say, well, you know, this patient doesn't have a very good quality of life. And that doesn't seem to be frequently something that they've had a long conversation with the family about, but they've made decisions about. And I'm wondering, because that oftentimes leads to, well, we shouldn't give them IV fluids. We shouldn't do lots of things for them because there's no quality of life. How does that conversation and your recommendation and with patients and with trainees, how do you go about defining quality?
Well, I think that quality of life in a situation like that is really in the eye of the beholder and in the eye of the person who's living it. And
so how do you ask that question?
In the case of the kind of patient you're talking about, they may not be able to respond, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
What I ask the family is, tell me about your dad. Tell me about your mom. What was this? What were they like? One of the things we have to do is to start by understanding who they were as a person before they had their Alzheimer's disease, before they had their stroke. And then learning about that, what do you think he or she would have thought about the situation now? And you'll get very different kinds of responses.
For the same patient.
Or sometimes you'll get different responses for the same patient. And you'll certainly get different responses for different patients with very similar diagnoses.
Yes.
That also kind of alludes to the challenge with feeding tubes. That is probably a topic we could do a whole show or more on. But these decisions about feeding a patient through a feeding tube when they're no longer at a place where they're taking food by mouth. And I found in those conversations with families that some families feel like, well, I have to do something. I can't just let my loved one starve and not eat. And other families who really want to sit down and think about, well, what would you want? And it's a very complex decision. Do you have any tips for providers or for families of a framework to think about those decisions?
Sure. I mean, it is very hard. And it's hard because feeding to us represents the basic sort of nurturing. How do we care for each other? How do we show our love for each other? We feed each other. This is
right.
What we do. And we all sit around the dining room table and we talk, and that's where our social life is. And so it's very hard to imagine not doing that. Maybe I'm sounding a little bit like a broken record, but it really comes back to the issue of goals. And what are the goals of putting in the feeding tube? If the family, as they understand the patient's wishes would have been, has the goal of prolonging the patient's life, for example, with the feeding tube, or of making them more comfortable, then in certain situations, for example, patients with advanced dementia, the literature is fairly clear that doesn't do that. And so therefore, they're not going to achieve that goal. If their goal is something else, either it's a religious belief that simply you can never stop feeding in certain situations, or if it's just their need to express that nurturing, then maybe they're going to achieve that goal with the feeding tube, and that's just a conversation we need to have.
Well, you know, speaking of conversations, and I guess that's one of the take-home messages that we'll leave here. We're talking with Dr. James Tolsky about palliative care. And Dr. Tolsky, you have a author on a new book that's out called Mastering Communication with Seriously Ill Patients, Balancing Honesty with Empathy and Hope. And I love those three terms. Tell us a little bit about the book and what you hope to achieve. How do you balance honesty with empathy and hope?
Well, our goal was to really teach healthcare providers. It's geared mostly toward physicians, but the book is great for nurses and other kinds of healthcare providers. And our premise is that so much of what happens in these conversations is about emotion, is about how people receive information when they're upset, how people need to have their emotions responded to. And so what we're trying to do here is to give a cognitive framework that uses that as really the core to teach healthcare providers to be able to see the emotional cues, the empathic opportunities, we call them, that arise from patients, and then how to respond with appropriate language.
It's so important. I mean, you are speaking our language. These are really important concepts.
Yeah, and it could be mastering communication. I also say from just hearing you today, it's mastering compassion for people, because hearing the questions that you ask, tell me about your life, indicates that you're ready to sit there with the patient for quite a while. This isn't a rushed conversation where you're standing above the patient and say, we need to talk about end-of-life decisions.
You know, it's not a rushed conversation, and I agree with you, and I think we need to do everything we can to make a patient feel like you are entirely there for them or their family. At the same time, one thing we've learned is that if you learn to do this well and you have the skills down, it doesn't take as long as everybody thinks. And that good, sometimes I find that doctors substitute time for skill because they want to show their presence with the patient. But in fact, if you use the right words, if you are able to really be there with somebody, you don't have to be there for a long time for them to notice.
So what's the name of that book again? And if people would like to get a copy of it, where can they order it from?
The name of the book is Mastering Communication with Seriously Ill Patients, Balancing Honesty with Empathy and Hope. And you can Google it under my name. I have two co-authors, Robert Arnold and Anthony Buck. And if you Google it on Amazon or any other dealer, you should be able to get it.
Well, Dr. Tulsky, we really appreciate you being with us and having this conversation today. And just for all the work you're doing to better train doctors and healthcare providers on how to care and really provide that compassionate care for our patients and families.
Thank you. I really appreciate
this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. On the House Call segment of our show today, we'll talk about your health questions, experiences, and attitudes.
And we want you to write us and share your questions and share your experiences with us, and we'll try to address your questions on an upcoming show. Please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And I'd like to ask our executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our first House Call.
Our first listener writes, I'm a young man who was recently diagnosed with anxiety. I have had chest pain for several months, and my doctor said it was not my heart, but my nerves. I admit I am nervous about many things, especially my health and having a heart attack. I smoke occasionally, but in reality, I have no major medical problems at all. How does anxiety really cause chest pain, and how often does it occur? What is the best treatment?
Well, thank you for writing us. This is, it's really poorly understood, I think, among doctors in the medical community, exactly how mental health, the exact relationship of how mental health affects so many different parts of your body. But we know that it's true that when you suffer from anxiety and worry, that it can have some really profound effects on how you feel, whether that's pain or pain in your chest or that overwhelming sense of anxiety.
Yeah, we know that, you know, when you get scared or the fight or flight reaction, your sympathetic nervous system, you know, pushes and your heart rate starts speeding up. We know that how the mind can control those things, and that begins to then really have effects on the body there. And so the answer, you know, yes, a bunch of really great questions, and it sounds very, very difficult for you, but the answer is yes. The anxiety really does cause the chest pain. It's real. And the treatment is multiple, really, one of which is, you know, you're self-medicating probably with nicotine and maybe getting away from the cigarettes, which could cause heart attacks, is going to be one of your treatments in addition to other medications and or psychological treatments.
Yeah, and thinking about things that can reduce your anxiety, we often talk about lots of different strategies like exercise, daily exercise, eating well and having a healthy lifestyle overall, about any stress reduction techniques that work for you. For some people, that might be taking a warm shower or
doing some meditation, some slow, deep breathing, some visual imaging exercises.
And certainly therapy or having someone to talk to about your feelings and working through that can be helpful, as well as sometimes medications.
Yep. So comprehensive approach, work with your primary care provider, work with a therapist, and you will get better. That's a fact.
All right. What do we have next, Julie?
I am 70 years old and was just diagnosed with irritable bowel disease. I thought that was a disease of younger people. I do seem to have most of the symptoms, but should I be worried my doctor has missed something?
Well, that's a that's another good question. I think if you the question of should you be worried your doctor has missed something is something that you should have that conversation with your doctor about how did your doctor go about hearing your symptoms and how did your doctor go about ruling out other things that can cause similar symptoms.
In addition to which, it sounds like you're worried that your doctor missed something regardless if your doctor and most times the doctors are pretty cautious about a 70-year-old who has some symptoms of the gastrointestinal tract that might be worrisome because we're always thinking the worst things first and, you know, cancer. So if they've come to that diagnosis, they've kind of maybe they haven't shared fully their reasoning. And so addressing your worry is still something that needs to happen.
Sure. And I mean, if you're 70 years old, you should have had your screening colonoscopy. And so I'm sure your doctor looked to see when's the last time you had an evaluation or screening for colon cancer to try to rule some of those things out before jumping to that diagnosis.
But irritable bowel disease can and does happen in people as they get older, just as it can in people who get younger. It's maybe not as well described, but we've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen. And, you know, there are probably things happening in your lifestyle right now that in your life that may be making it worse. And these are things, again, to explore with. It takes time, though, and you're going to have to spend some time with your doctor to really talk about this.
Absolutely. Julie, what do we have next?
My mother was recently diagnosed with a fatty liver. She is a little overweight, but she is not fat. The doctor said it even looked like she had developed pretty bad liver disease. This sounds really bad. Any advice?
Tough case. You know, we're getting, Chrissy, our cases today are about people being diagnosed, yet not having all the information, perhaps. And this is a common theme here beyond this particular case, but it was there in the other two cases. You know, it's tough because you get diagnoses and then you may not have enough time to ask the types of questions you want to ask, just like this one.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, fatty liver is a diagnosis that's very common and a lot of times happens in women who are overweight and may not be, you know, you say that your mom is not fat, that even just having some excess weight puts you at higher risk for having fatty liver disease.
And unfortunately, whereas most people that really does not go on to develop severe liver disease or what we might call cirrhosis or scarring in the liver, it certainly can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the treatment for this really is, and the only one that they think really can avoid it, is weight loss. And it may still be indicated, though, in your mother.
It really might. So this again speaks to, I mean, the same thing we were saying with the other questions is, you know, it's one thing to go into your doctor and get that diagnosis, and it sounds like you still have questions. So going back and making another appointment to say, I understand you've given this diagnosis, I've done some reading, and now I want to talk to you more about what does this mean? What does this mean for her future? What can we do?
And you know, this is one of those cases where if you wanted to talk with a liver specialist, it would mm-hmm. certainly be indicated because, you know, bad liver disease means that you may be at risk for all kinds of problems down the road and which medicines you can take and not take. So good luck. We're sorry that this happened, and we really hope that you get the treatment that you need.
Absolutely.
What's our very last house call, Julie?
I've recently been diagnosed with endometriosis, and my husband and I have also been talking about having a baby in the next few years. Can you tell me if endometriosis affects fertility?
That is a really good question, and it's wonderful that you're planning in advance for having a family. There is a relationship between endometriosis and having problems conceiving a child in that it's more common for women who have trouble becoming pregnant to have endometriosis, but certainly not all people who have endometriosis have any problems at all getting pregnant.
Yeah, and it's a little bit less clear if this decrease in the ability to get pregnant is due to some changes in hormones or is it due to changes in the anatomy? Because there's lots of things that can happen with endometriosis, including scarring within the pelvis that can distort the normal structure and scar the tubes where eggs get transported. And as well as some of the hormonal changes that can occur that can impact on your ability actually to ovulate.
And there is some data to say that up to 70% of women who have mild and moderate endometriosis will conceive within 3 years of trying without any specific treatment. But then there are also treatment options if you do have trouble getting pregnant, like medication, surgery, and other assisted reproduction techniques. So there's a lot of technology out there right now that can help if that even becomes a problem for you, and hopefully it won't.
Well, again, Chris, this is another example of needing more time for patient education, a common theme of today. But we've been able to talk a little bit about this endometriosis and fertility.
A little bit about anxiety and chest pain.
The fact that irritable bowel disease can happen as you get older, but also need to talk with your doctor about your concerns.
And a little bit about fatty liver.
Yeah, well, that's going to conclude what we can talk about on Here's to Your Health today. And we hope that we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can share your own health-related questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us on Twitter even by going to twitter.com/HTYH. I kind of like that, Christy. We're searching for Here's to Your Health.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. James Tulsky. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.